I believe that during the 30s, Mahatma Gandhi was often in Pune, sometimes in and sometimes out of prison. I wonder if you have any memories of him at that time.
Well, my very first meeting with him was in the central jail at Yerauda, Pune, where I went to see him a few weeks after I arrived in India. He was allowed at that time to receive visitors who wished to talk to him about his work for the Harijans, but not on political matters. And I did go to ask him questions on this subject. And I can remember my first impressions of him. He was in the courtyard of the prison, lying on a string cot, a charpoy, under a little mango tree, and talking with Gujarati friends, possibly from his own ashram. And then he turned to me, and I remember the tremendous impression of such a personality being entirely concentrated upon you at such a moment. He's a very delightful and simple person, tremendously interested always in nature medicine, and his chief concern was with a sore place on my foot, for which he recommended mud plasters, which rather surprised me. But from that time on, I maintained a very close touch with him over the years. Later that same year, he went on a sudden and unexpected fast because his privileges of talking with those concerned with the Harijan movement were withdrawn. And so rapidly did he deteriorate in the prison that he was released and moved to the hospital in Pune. And at that time, C.F. Andrews came to stay with us and used to go down to visit him almost daily. And he came back one evening with the very moving story that Bapu, as he was generally known to his close associates, had practically given up hope of life. And Andrews had challenged him by saying, "If you die, Bapu, who will reconcile India with the British?" And he seemed to respond to the challenge and slowly built up his strength. He later moved to another house in Pune, in which he actually visited the ashram on one of his early morning walks after he'd recovered. But on a number of occasions he used to come to Pune. I used to think for the same reason the British used to put him there. And nobody much took notice of him in Pune, because the Maharashtrians had a little affection for Gujaratis. In fact, I remember once when he was there, a good Brahmin of Pune saying to me, "Ah, that Gujarati fellow." Very often in Pune he used to stay at the Natural Health Clinic behind the station, and it was there I had a number of very notable talks with him, especially on the relation of religion and education. But once or twice he stayed with Lady Thackeray at her humble palace called Parnakuti, on the other side of the river from the Bund Garden Bridge. And there I remember witnessing the marriage of Devadas, his youngest son, to the daughter of Raja Gopalacharya. And also being present at the breaking of one of his fasts, when two of us from the ashram sang a Christian hymn while there were readings from the Quran and the Avesta, as well as from the Hindu scriptures in the ceremony of the fast breaking.
Could you tell us something about your impressions of C.F. Andrews?
C.F. Andrews I met on this occasion in 1933 when he stayed with us at the ashram, and I met him several times afterwards, particularly once at Wardha when Gandhi first moved there, and because he had vowed not to return to his own original home, the ashram of Sabarmati, until India was free. And he had to look about for another home after he came out of prison. And he was staying in Wardha, in Vinoba Bhave's ashram, till the right spot should be found. And at that time, C.F. Andrews spoke to me about some conversations he'd had with the Mahatma, trying to discover the reasons for his fasts, of which there had been quite a number in his life. And he at last came to the conclusion that the fundamental reason was that Gandhiji would not allow the normal expression of concern in anger, and when something happened, either in the political field or in his own inner group of disciples, or his own family, which greatly distressed him, he redirected his feelings into the self-castigation of a fast. And I've often thought that perhaps this insight was of interest and value.
C.F. Andrews once told me that he was against the fasts to death and always tried to prevent Gandhi from undertaking them after the Puna fasts about the Harijans, and because he believed this was against the sort of general principle of fasting as a penance. What would you think that was his attitude?
Yes, I think it was, but I think he began to realize there was something psychological about them for which little could be done. I remember as a young man, after that first visit to Gandhi, writing to him a letter to the jail, raising in question the moral ethics of compulsion by fasts, suggesting that it was a breach of the principle of ahimsa, non-violence, to which he was pledged, and getting back a most patient and interesting letter to my extremely youthful and impertinent remarks, in which he did defend what he was doing as something a father might well do for the correction of a child. And I think that is really how he looked upon it. But certainly there were always occasions of great anxiety, these fasts, though he conducted them under medical supervision and generally used to have a saline drink, I think, to modify their effects. Actually, I don't think he undertook another fast after that Puna one until the fast he undertook in his last imprisonment in the palace of the Aga Khan on the further side of Puna, where I also visited him just before the breaking of the fast. The government wouldn't let us be present at any ceremony at the actual end of the fast.
And do you think that there was anything in the criticism of Gandhiji at that time, that when he was had become very weak, he was said to have taken some liquid nourishment?
Apart from the water, which he did take, with, I think, salt, as I said, I'm quite sure that if he had taken any other kind of liquid, he would certainly have said so. There never was a more truthful man, and never a man more ready to expose his own weaknesses, sometimes quite embarrassingly. In fact, I think there's little that has been said in criticism of Gandhiji which is not to be found in his own writing.
Had he got any answer to the argument that a faster death was a form of compulsion or moral blackmail?
His answer to me was not a direct one, but he did quote, curious enough, the cross. And our Lord's use of that as a means of redeeming mankind. But it does seem to me that he thought that the castigation which he couldn't inflict upon those who had roused his disquiet could quite rightly be taken upon himself. He usually put a term to any fast he undertook. And I think was careful, as far as could be, to avoid the possibility of death. The only one where it really seemed to me to be a danger was that sudden, unexpected one he took in 1933 in the jail in response to the withdrawal of his privileges of continuing his work for the Harijans. And that might well have ended in death, but it wasn't a kind of premeditated fast, as most of the others were.
The Harijan leader, Dr. Ambedkar, always thought that he'd been blackmailed into making concessions or to Gandhi and the Hindus by this fast to death.
Well, I must admit I used to feel that there was a very fine line between a compulsion of this kind and a fundamental reaction to some circumstances which disturbed him. And certainly, as I say, I took the same problem up within myself. I think possibly C.F. Andrews was right in thinking that in certain situations there was no other way of Gandhiji expressing his distress than by this way, as he was forbidden by his principles of exercising himsa and turning in violence on those who had distressed him.
Yeah. Now, there is a very talented Hindu scholar who has recently published a book in which he maintains that Gandhiji had developed a new world ethic. It's not just non-violence, not just ahimsa, but a new world ethic. Would you feel that there was justice in that claim?
Well, it's... It's a rather hard question to answer straight away. I think in some ways the term non-violence was an unfortunate one. Satyagraha seems to express the same thing more positively, and the word he liked to use, the idea of truth force, and there's something more positive and constructive in that conception. And I have a feeling that at least he had thereby discovered and developed a fresh way of dealing with the problems of tension between peoples and races and even countries. Whether you would call it a new ethic, I should somewhat doubt. A new method of applying principles of ethics in certain situations, I think you could say he had discovered. And of course they were applied elsewhere, as by Martin Luther King in America, with a very considerable effect. The fundamental principle, as he himself would be ready to admit, really goes back to our Lord and the Christian principles. And in his own autobiography he says that he was led to them really by such Christian writers as Tolstoy and Ruskin.
You became Bishop of Bombay just as independence was being declared in August 1947, and there must have been a traumatic experience for the large European community in Bombay to find themselves under an Indian government for the first time. Could you tell us something of what was the effect on the Europeans of this development?
On the official Europeans, it had the immediate effect of their disappearance. Even some who had shown themselves extremely sympathetic to the Indian aspirations and were greatly admired and even loved by Indians seemed to have to go because of the strong feeling that there should be nothing that an Indian could not do. And however effective and valuable a European contribution had been, it ought really to be dispensed with. This seems to have been in great contrast to what happened in Pakistan, where, as far as I can gather, the Europeans in the ICS and so on continued for some time. Certainly they were very rare in India. As far as the church was concerned, the establishment chaplains all went within a few months, which caused quite a serious adjustment in the life and work of the church. And one of the things which first brought me face to face with the Europeans of Bombay, who were engaged in finance and commerce and continued in equal numbers after independence as before, and seemed quite at home in doing so in the early days. And they were very concerned as to whether there would be ministrations for them in the future, and I remember talked with the leaders, especially the head of the Chamber of Commerce and the head of the United Kingdom Citizens Association, as to whether we could make such arrangements. I had to make it clear to them that the Church of India now was entirely on its own, and we could make no distinction with regard to salaries for priests and that kind of thing, but did allow for the European community raising funds to provide for passages and perhaps special overseas allowances if we could bring priests from England to help in ministry to them. And something of that kind was done. One of the interesting elements in the situation was the setting up of the High Commissioner's functions in India. In Bombay we had a deputy High Commissioner. I think he had been in service in Hong Kong or somewhere like that in the diplomatic service, and he found it quite difficult to realize what had happened when he moved to India. I remember being very intrigued a few months after I arrived in having a visit from him, when he asked me what I intended to do with the reserved seats in the cathedral, which had brass labels on them. reserving for the governor and the chief minister and other such dignities. And I said to him, well, between you and me, but you mustn't tell anybody else, but at midnight on December the 31st, 1947, I should like to go in with a screwdriver and remove them all. But I found he was a very serious person and was suggesting to me that the governor's seat should now become the seat of the Deputy High Commissioner. I had to point out to him that he was now in the Church of India, and by chance the governor of Bombay, the first Indian governor, was not only a Christian but an Anglican, and a very distinguished one. And it would be rather lacking in tact to remove his place. But being a bachelor, I offered him the Episcopal seat, the bishop under the old regime, being third in the hierarchy in the state, was bang behind the governor. So he was content with that. But that rather showed a problem which was quite difficult over the years, the relation of the commissioner in matters which concerned the crown and the Indian government, which was a part of the Commonwealth. For instance, when George VI died, the Indian government was quite clear that they were involved, and arrangements for a memorial service in the cathedral, they took a very early initiative. And of course the High Commissioner's office was also brought in to the arrangement. But only a year later, with the enthronement of Queen Elizabeth II, the Indian government went on hesitating so long that the High Commission, Deputy High Commissioner, got quite annoyed with the bishop because he wouldn't at once take some action. But there were problems of that kind in adjustment between the two. But at first, as I say, the European community did not seem to be much disturbed. Though slowly but surely, the Indian government brought pressure to bear, first on the finance and then on the personnel in former European firms. And I think slowly one could see the time coming when the reason for the British ever entering India would soon be removed, and the shaking of the pagoda tree would have to cease.
Did the Europeans who were resident in Bombay find it difficult to adjust to the new situation, one feature of which was prohibition?
Well, of course, it had one very unhappy effect. It didn't affect the Europeans much because there were licenses given quite freely to foreigners. But it did break up what had been one of the most cosmopolitan social lives anywhere in India, because the only original inhabitants of the Bombay Islands were the fisher folk. So everybody who was in Bombay, whether they were Hindu, Parsi, Muslim, or the European, was from outside. And there was a very happy relationship, especially in commercial circles, with all communities. But when regulations came out that you couldn't drink at a social occasion in the presence of somebody who hadn't got a permit to drink, it did make social life very difficult, and had a rather unhappy effect on that close interrelationship between the communities. But the direct effect on the European community on its own was inconvenient rather than really disastrous.
I once stayed in Bombay in a new hotel which I was told had been built on the site of the Bombay Club, which had gone out of business because of prohibition.
I wonder about that. I don't quite know which club it referred to, whether it was the famous Bombay Club, That certainly went on for a good long time after independence. It might have been the Bicolour Club, but that had nothing to do with prohibition. The Bicolour Club, which was perhaps the most famous of the lot, that certainly disappeared. But I don't think the prohibition had anything to do with that. Its disappearance was already provided for before independence actually arrived. Mm. The Royal Yacht Club suffered the loss of its main premises, but that was simply because its lease ran out and the new authorities were not prepared to let them have another. But there really was very little place for exclusively European clubs in Bombay once independence had come. And certainly they had to adjust themselves.